What if I told you that the exact same mathematical ratio that dictates like the spiral of a sunflower?
Oh, right, the golden ratio.
Yeah, exactly. The curve of a hurricane, the architecture of the Parthenon. What if that same ratio is secretly controlling the atoms inside your body?
That's a pretty wild thought, honestly.
It really is. I mean, we might have been reading the periodic table of elements wrong for, well, over a century.
Easily over a century.
Because you know that feeling when you first look at the periodic table? You're like standing there in some high school chemistry lab, staring up at this massive, overwhelming chart on the wall.
Oh, it is incredibly intimidating for most people.
Right. It's just this jagged castle of blocks packed with disconnected numbers, weird coloring schemes, and just a seemingly endless list of frustrating quantum exceptions.
Yeah, and we are taught to read it like a book, you know, left to right, starting with hydrogen at the top left.
Which makes sense intuitively, but
But almost immediately, the rules we're taught just start breaking down.
yeah, they really do.
You have to memorize when an atom mysteriously decides to skip a subshell, or why a certain transition metal behaves completely differently than the one sitting right next to it. It just feels completely chaotic and disjointed.
But what if it isn't chaotic at all? Like, what if we've just been holding the map upside down, or rather, reading it backward?
That is exactly what we're getting into today.
Right, because that is the mission of this deep dive. You've brought this truly fascinating paper to us, titled A Noble Gas-Centered Coordinate for Within-Period Atomic Property Trends.
By Washburn, Simons, and Alioroff.
Yes, them. And honestly, their core argument completely flips the script on chemistry.
It really does. It's a total paradigm shift.
Because they demonstrate how a single elegant mathematical equation using the golden ratio can organize four major atomic properties onto one simple continuous axis.
And we're talking about major fundamental properties here.
Right, ionization energy, electron affinity, electronegativity, and chemical hardness. All just falling nicely into a predictable mathematical line. So, okay, let's unpack this. What does it actually mean to look at the periodic table in a totally new way?
Well, to understand what these researchers have fundamentally shifted, we have to completely change how we measure an element's position.
Okay, so how do we usually do it?
For over 100 years, the convention has been to start our measurements from the left side of the table. We look at the alkali metals, like lithium or sodium, and we count outward to the right.
Right, one, two, three, moving across the row.
Exactly. But this new framework throws that out the window. It introduces a continuous coordinate, which the researchers call rho, like the Greek letter rho.
Okay, row, got it.
And it measures displacement from the right side of the table, specifically from the noble gas that closes out the row, or the period, as we call it in chemistry.
So if you're looking at the row that ends with neon, neon is now ground zero.
Neon is absolute zero on this new coordinate system.
Wow, okay.
And as you move backward to the left, across the row, your rho value increases as a fraction.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so by the time you reach the alkali metal all the way at the far left side, you are at the maximum fraction for that row.
There's not a whole number.
Right. For instance, in a standard row of eight elements, that alkali metal sits at a value of 7/8. You are always, always measuring the distance remaining to the noble gas.
That immediately makes me think of like a track race.
Oh, yeah? How so?
It's like measuring a runner's distance, not by how far they've run from the starting gun, but by their exact remaining distance to the finish line. Like the noble gas is the finish line.
That is a brilliant way to picture it, actually.
Thanks. And to map this out, the researchers built a landscape function for this coordinate system, which they named JChem.
Right, JChem. And it uses this sweeping mathematical curve called a hyperbolic cosine.
A Koch curve, right? Like for you listening, if you picture the smooth curve of a heavy chain hanging between two poles, that's a Koch curve.
Exactly. But the really wild part is how it scales that coordinate.
The golden ratio.
Yes. It uses phi, the golden ratio, which is roughly 1.618.
It's just crazy to me that phi shows up here.
What's fascinating here is that the noble gases are the natural empirical zero of chemistry.
Because they're stable.
Exactly. Think about it from a physical standpoint. Noble gases have completely closed, perfectly full electron shells.
They don't want to play with anyone else.
Right. They are perfectly stable, meaning they don't want to react with anything. They are the stable endpoints of atomic architecture.
Okay, that makes sense.
From that point of perfect stability, as you move left and begin opening up those electron shells, the atomic properties change monotonically.
Monotonically, meaning They just go in one direction.
Basically, yeah. It just means they follow a consistent, continuous, one-way direction. So it makes complete logical sense to put your zero at the point of maximum stability and measure everything relative to that perfection.
Which perfectly sets us up for what this mathematical landscape actually predicts. Let's look at the first major property this equation tackles, which is first, ionization energy.
Right, the energy to remove an electron.
Yeah, for you listening, if you need a quick refresher, ionization energy is basically the ransom money you have to pay an atom to rip one of its outermost electrons away.
The ransom money. I like that.
It's a measure of how tightly the atom is holding onto its pieces, you know? So if we apply this golden ratio landscape, what does it tell us?
Well, this is where the geometric constants start doing things that seem almost magical.
Magical how?
The authors present a couple of major predictions regarding this ransom money. Prediction one focuses exclusively on the heavy noble gases.
Okay.
If you take the ionization energy of one heavy noble gas and divide it by the ionization energy of the next heaviest one beneath it on the table.
So like argon divided by krypton.
Exactly. Or krypton divided by xenon. The ratio is incredibly consistent across the board.
But it's not just a random fraction, is it?
No, it equals the golden ratio to the power of 1/4.
5 to the 1/4 power.
Right, which calculates out to about 1.1278.
And does that hold up in the real world?
Oh, beautifully. When you compare this purely mathematical prediction to the actual empirical data measured in labs by the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, it matches to about a 1% mean absolute deviation.
A 1% deviation. That is stunningly accurate.
It really is.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around that. You're taking a mathematical concept that, like, ancient Greek architects used to build temples, and you're finding it hiding in the atomic energy levels of krypton gas.
It's poetry in a way.
It really is. But the paper doesn't stop with just the noble gases.
Yeah.
There's prediction two, which looks at the opposite ends of a single row.
Extremes.
Right, the halogens, which are elements like chlorine or bromine, sitting just one spot away from the finish line, compared to the alkalis like sodium or potassium, which are all the way back at the start of the row.
Right, the two extremes of the reactive spectrum. If you take the ionization energy of the halogen and divide it by the ionization energy of the alkali in that exact same period.
Same row.
Yes, the ratio equals 5 squared, the golden ratio is squared, which is about 2.618.
Okay, wow.
And when tested across periods 3 through 6 on the periodic table, this purely mathematical constant matches the real-world data with only about a 5% error.
Okay, I have to step in and push back here.
Sure, go for it.
You just mentioned a 5% error. Wait, does this mathematical magic work perfectly for every single element? Or are there, you know, glaring exceptions?
That is a very fair point.
Because if it's supposed to be a universal law, a 5% deviation feels like a crack in the foundation. Like maybe the math isn't perfect.
That is a crucial question to ask. No, it absolutely does not work perfectly for every atom in the universe. And honestly, the authors are very upfront about that.
Okay, so they admit the flaws.
But those exceptions aren't failures of the model. They are exactly what make this framework so incredibly valuable for physicists.
How so?
Let's look at two major outliers, oganesson and fluorine. Oganesson is the heaviest noble gas we know of, sitting way down at the absolute bottom right of the table, element 118.
A massive atom.
Exactly. When you calculate its ionization energy ratio against radon, the energy required to steal an electron actually drops about 7.6% below what the golden ratio predicts.
Okay, so why does it drop? Did the golden ratio finally break down?
The math didn't break. The physical rules of the universe shifted.
What do you mean?
The mathematical model is non-relativistic, but oganesson is what we call a super heavy element. Its nucleus is packed with 118 protons.
That's a lot of positive charge.
That positive charge is so massively strong that its innermost electrons have to travel at a significant fraction of the speed of light just to stay in orbit without crashing into the nucleus.
Whoa, hold on. Electrons moving near the speed of light?
Yep.
What does relativity have to do with how easily I can pull an electron away from the outside of the atom?
Well, when things move that fast, Einstein's theory of relativity kicks in. The electrons physically gain mass.
They get heavier.
Yes, and this alters the shape of their orbits in a phenomenon called spin orbit splitting.
Spin orbit splitting, okay.
Specifically for oganesson, relativity splits its outer 7p3/2 shell, essentially pushing that outermost electron further away and making it much less tightly bound than classical physics would ever expect. So it's just easier to pull away.
Ah, so the math isn't wrong. It's accurately describing a perfect classical universe.
Exactly.
It's showing us exactly what Oganessen would look like if relativity wasn't violently warping the atom.
You've hit on the exact utility of the model, and fluorine breaks the rule for a completely different reason.
Okay, what's fluorine's excuse?
Fluorine sits at the top right of the table. It's a very small halogen. Now, the mathematical framework assumes a certain amount of screening.
Screening.
Screening is the idea that the inner layers of electrons act like a shield, blocking some of the nucleus's positive pull so the outermost electrons aren't held as tightly.
Let me try an analogy here to put that in everyday terms for you listening. Imagine trying to feel the heat of a light bulb, but someone has placed like three thick lampshades over it.
Oh, I like that.
Those lampshades are the inner electrons, right? Screening the heat from reaching you on the outside.
That's a perfect way to visualize it. But fluorine is so tiny that it has no inner P-shell lampshades to screen its outer electrons.
Oh, so it's just a bare bulb.
Basically. The valence electrons feel the raw, unshielded pull of the nucleus. Because of that, fluorine holds on to its electrons way tighter than the baseline formula predicts.
So the model is doing exactly what it's supposed to do.
Right. This framework isn't a replacement for quantum mechanics. Instead, it acts as a perfect, smooth, non-relativistic baseline.
You use this beautiful golden ratio curve as the standard, and when an atom deviates from it, you instantly know exactly how large those messy quantum or relativistic anomalies are.
That's exactly it.
Well, here's where it gets really interesting, because you just mentioned that smooth baseline. So far, we've only talked about the extremes, right?
Right, the ends of the rows.
The golden ratio perfectly predicts the noble gases at the finish line and the halogens and alkalis at the very edges. But what happens in the messy middle of the periodic table?
The journey across the row.
Exactly. If I'm looking at a row of 8 or 18 elements, how does the math handle that journey?
This brings us to prediction 3, the within period envelope.
This is where we examine the shape of the entire row or period. The model predicts that if you start at the noble gas,
the absolute peak of stability.
Right. And you move backward toward the alkali metal, the ionization energy should fall in a perfectly smooth monotonic descent. No random zigzags, just a clean mathematical curve sliding down the landscape function.
The visual analogy that immediately comes to mind here is like a ski slope.
Ski slope?
Yeah, imagine standing at the top of a pristine snow-covered mountain. That peak is the noble gas holding its electrons with maximum force.
Okay, I see where you go.
And as you ski down to the bottom of the mountain, arriving at the alkali metal, the mathematical model draws this perfect untouched slope. But reality is a bit bumpier.
Right, because in reality, the researchers tested 34 atoms across periods 2, 3, and 4. And while 26 of them glided perfectly down that mathematical slope, 8 of them hit moguls.
Moguls, I love that.
It popped upward, sharply deviating from the smooth descent.
And those moguls are arguably the most important part of the paper, because those 8 atoms didn't deviate randomly.
They did it.
No, they deviated exactly at textbook chemical anomaly sites. We're talking about elements like nitrogen, phosphorus, and zinc.
Known troublemakers.
Exactly. In chemistry, we already know these specific elements have slightly higher ionization energies than their neighbors because of their internal architecture. Nitrogen and phosphorus have exactly half-filled P3 shells. Zinc has a perfectly closed S2 shell.
Okay, I want to make sure we don't lose anyone in the quantum alphabet soup here. Let's break down a half-filled P3 shell.
Go for it.
To put that in everyday terms for you listening, imagine a bus where the seats are arranged in pairs. A half-filled shell is like a bus where exactly one person is sitting in every single seat pair.
Everyone gets a window seat.
Exactly. It's perfectly symmetrical. It's balanced. The bus driver, the atom, is perfectly happy with this arrangement and doesn't want anyone new getting on and definitely doesn't want anyone being pulled off.
That symmetry creates stability, known in physics as Hund exchange stabilization.
Hund exchange?
Yes. Because the atom is comfortably balanced, it requires extra energy, a bigger ransom, to rip an electron away. So the atom bumps up on the graph.
So again, the model isn't failing when it misses those 8 atoms.
Not at all. It is drawing the underlying terrain so perfectly that it acts as a topographical map, clearly highlighting exactly where those quantum moguls are sitting. It proves the periodic table is fundamentally smooth, just punctuated by these specific, well-known subshell stabilizations.
Though looking at the data in the paper, there is one extreme counterexample in period 7 that absolutely destroys the ski slope.
Yes, period 7.
We have to talk about Copernicium.
Yeah.
Element 112. It essentially launches off a ramp on the ski slope, right?
It's a massive outlier. Remember, the foundational rule of the model is that the noble gas is the absolute peak of the mountain.
Right.
Nothing in the row should hold onto its electrons tighter than the noble gas at the top. But Copernicium experiences something called extreme relativistic super inert pair stabilization.
There's that word again. Relativity. So Copernicium is so heavy that the electrons are doing the light speed dance again.
Exactly. The relativistic effects are so intense that its outer seven's electrons are literally sucked inward, physically closer to the massive nucleus, making them incredibly hard to remove.
Wow.
As a result, its ionization energy actually pushes higher than the noble gas oganesson at the end of its row. Copernicium entirely breaks the envelope rule.
It's holding on tighter than the noble gas.
Right. But again, the authors argue it breaks it because of extreme relativity, proving yet again that the non-relativistic baseline is doing its job.
By serving as an unmoving backdrop to highlight these massive physical distortions.
Exactly.
Okay, I love this. It's like we finally have a straight mathematical edge to hold up against the periodic table so we can clearly see exactly where the quantum bumps and relativistic dents are.
That's a great way to summarize it.
But taking a step back, the true power of this paper isn't just about ionization energy, is it?
No, it goes much deeper.
It's how the authors take this exact same mathematical curve, this Koch function based on the golden ratio, and recycle it to predict three entirely different chemical properties. Let's get into what they call the shared kernel.
This is where the mathematical elegance becomes almost poetic. The researchers took their landscape function and turned their attention to electron affinity and Pearson chemical hardness.
Two completely different things.
Right. Now, these are conceptually very different from ionization energy. Ionization is taking an electron away. Electron affinity is essentially the opposite. It measures how much an atom wants to gain an extra electron.
Okay, so taking versus gaining.
And chemical hardness.
Let me guess. It's not about how hard the atom is if you hit it with a tiny hammer.
Not quite. Think of an atom's electron cloud like a balloon. Chemical hardness measures how firmly that balloon resists being squeezed or deformed when it interacts with other atoms.
Okay, so we have wanting an electron and resisting deformation. Conceptually distinct.
Very distinct. But the model uses the exact same inward geometric measurement, what they call the landscape gap, for both of them.
I want to make sure I'm picturing this right. Let's use a metaphor. It's like having an architectural blueprint.
Okay.
The researchers are saying you can use the exact same blueprint, the shared kernel, to build a library, which is electron affinity, or to build a fortress, which is chemical hardness.
I see.
The only difference is the scale of the materials you use for that specific row of the periodic table.
The blueprint analogy is spot on. They use the same fundamental geometry. Because electron affinity and hardness share the exact same mathematical kernel, the model makes a very bold prediction.
Right.
If you divide an atom's electron affinity by its hardness, the resulting ratio should be a constant number for any given period on the table.
Okay, pure geometry predicting the relationship between two messy, real-world chemical properties. Does it actually hold up in the lab?
Spectacularly well. Let's look at period four. The model's pure geometry predicts that the ratio of affinity to hardness should be 0.182.
Okay, 0.182.
When you take the actual empirical data from NIST, measurements taken from real atoms, and calculate the average for that period, the real-world ratio is 0.1018 hours.
Wait, really?
Yes. The pure mathematical prediction is accurate to better than 1%.
That is staggering. You take two completely different properties,
yeah,
measured in complex laboratory experiments, and their relationship to one another is basically hard-coded into this golden ratio geometry.
It's undeniably elegant.
And incredibly, they didn't even stop at three properties. They applied this blueprint to a fourth. Mellican electronegativity.
Right, electronegativity. It's essentially the atomic tug of war.
Tug of war.
Yeah, when two atoms form a chemical bond and share electrons, electronegativity measures how strongly one atom pulls those shared electrons toward itself.
Okay, so how does the math handle that?
In this golden ratio framework, it is calculated simply as the halfway point, the half sum, between the outward step of ionization and the inward gap of electron affinity. They took this single coordinate kernel and tested it against 15 different atoms spanning four distinct chemical classes.
And we are talking about wildly different classes of elements here.
Yeah.
Halogens, alkalis, mid-D transition metals, and chalcogens, which for the listener, is just the scientific name for the oxygen family.
So did the golden blueprint fit all of them?
It fit them beautifully. It achieved an R-squared correlation of 0.73 globally.
Okay, for those of us who haven't taken statistics recently, what does an R-squared of 0.73 actually mean in this context? Is that good?
An R-squared value measures how well the real-world data fits the theoretical mathematical line. A 1.0 would be absolute perfection.
So, in the messy reality of quantum chemistry, achieving a 0.73 across multiple, completely distinct chemical families is a massive signal. It means this isn't just statistical noise.
It's a real pattern.
It indicates a strong underlying universal relationship. If we connect this to the bigger picture, the significance of this cannot be overstated. We are talking about uniting four historically separate spectroscopic numbers under one single geometric roof.
Because before this, they were all treated separately.
Exactly. For decades, ionization energy, electron affinity, hardness, and electronegativity were treated as separate phenomena, requiring their own independent quantum calculations. This framework proves that within a period, these properties are essentially just different expressions of the exact same underlying shape.
So what does this all mean? For you listening, whether you're prepping for a chemistry exam, working in a material science lab, or just insanely curious about how the universe is stitched together, why does this matter?
It's about simplifying our understanding.
Right. It means the periodic table doesn't have to be a nightmare of rote memorization. It's not just a messy filing cabinet of disparate, disconnected data points.
Not anymore, at least.
By simply measuring an element's distance to the nearest noble gas, and applying a sweeping mathematical curve based on the golden ratio, you can map the fundamental properties of the elements. It completely combats information overload.
It really does.
Instead of memorizing 1,000 random rules, you have a compact, analytical reference that explains the actual shape of chemistry.
It provides profound clarity. You have the ideal mathematical form, and you have the physical experimental reality. By placing them over each other, the deviations...
The quantum speed bumps.
Yes. The speed bumps and the relativistic heavyweights, they stand out in sharp relief. They are perfectly quantified rather than just being annoying exceptions. This raises an important question, though, one that goes beyond just chemistry and borders on the philosophical.
Oh, I know exactly where you're going with this.
If this purely phenomenological equation using phi, the golden ratio, a number famous for dictating the spiral of a nautilus shell, the arrangement of seeds in a sunflower, and the proportions of ancient architecture.
Right, the stuff of nature and art.
Exactly. If this specific mathematical ratio can predict atomic energy levels with 1% accuracy, is phi somehow deeply, secretly baked into the foundational physical laws of quantum mechanics?
Yeah.
Or is this all just an incredibly lucky, beautiful mathematical coincidence?
Man, that is the thought to leave on. Are atoms basically just tiny quantum sunflowers? I absolutely love it.
It's a great image.
It really is. Next time you see a periodic table hanging in a classroom or a lab, I hope you don't just see a frustrating, chaotic chart of blocks. I hope you see that perfectly smooth ski slope, starting at the noble gases, riding the golden ratio all the way down to the alkalis. Thank you for joining us on this exploration. Until next time.